Welcome back to the Paranorm Girl podcast. I am your host, Kristen. The idea that a person's spirit, their essence, can linger following the death of the physical body is an ancient one, a deeply rooted concept across all of humankind that has been traced across burial sites from the ancient world. Human history is rife with ghosts, their stories ingraining themselves into the folklores of cultures across the globe and across time, making their way throughout the centuries, even to this day. Of all of the paranormal beliefs one could ever consider, there are two that stand out as traceable to the earliest days of the written record: the belief about the spirit in the afterlife, and the belief about the ghost here on Earth. To be fair, it had one of the best vehicles to carry it throughout the ages and help cement its place in our collective consciousness: the ghost story. The first recorded use of a word to describe the manifestation that survives human death is from a tablet dated to the early 3rd millennium BCE, inscribed with the cuneiform character for the Sumerian word for ghost, Gidim. The Sumerians' belief in the afterlife was a bit depressing. Heaven was reserved for the deities alone, and all mortals following death and despite how they lived their life were sent to Kur, the underworld, a dark, drab, cavernous space beneath the earth. The spirits there would continue in existence somewhat resembling their lives on Earth, equipped with homes and tasks and friends who were also deceased. It was thought, though, that a soul could gain a more favorable experience and existence in the underworld depending on how they had been buried and if offerings were made by the living. Because it was believed all there was to eat in Kur was dry dust, the living descendants would pour liquid through clay pipes into the person's grave and also leave treasures and offerings in hopes that the deceased could, in a sense, buy a better life of the deities residing in and ruling over Kur. If a deceased person had not received a decent burial, did not receive libations or offerings if they had been left unburied, if they had been buried but their grave or tomb was allowed to go untended, these unhappy people were believed to become restless and would haunt the living unless it was made right. Gidim were believed to retain their character and personality from life, whether that be kind and demure to "I want to speak to your manager, Karen," or even more malicious than that. That's pretty malicious, but they could be rather nasty. Anyone could be a restless spirit, from children to the very old, from slaves to the very rich, if somehow they had been unhappy with their burial, of course, and they could appear displaying characteristics of the ways in which they died. And Gidim, along with certain gods or demons, were believed to be capable of bringing misfortune and inducing illness and maladies in the living. Ailments included anything as benign as headaches and ear ringing to severe neurological and mental disorders. These earliest of recorded beliefs lent themselves to the earliest of ghost stories. The oldest documented ghost story that I could find was written sometime between 1292 and 1077 BC. It was recovered from ancient Egypt, told through hieroglyphics. Some of the story has been lost, but from the remainder we learn of a priest named Khonsumhep and his encounter with a restless spirit. A man spent the night next to a tomb in the Theban necropolis, but was awakened from slumber by a ghost residing within it. He goes to Khonsumhep to tell his tale. The priest then summons the ghost from his rooftop. Upon his summoning, Khonsumhep gets his name and then offers to build the ghost a new tomb and provide him with a coffin in hopes of bringing him peace, which makes the ghost all the more unhappy. See, for centuries, his burial tomb had been collapsing, falling into ruin. For centuries, he had encountered others who had offered to rebuild it, but alas, no one had made good on their promise. But Consum Hep was different. Consum Hep was an honorable fella. He sends men to find a suitable new location to rebuild, and they return joyful to proclaim they have indeed found the perfect spot. And because hieroglyphics are old as hell, and everything was etched into literal rocks that crumble and fall apart, that is all we know of the story. The rest is lost. But what a cliffhanger, though, right? Let's just think about this for a second before moving on. Sumerians literally invented writing. They invented the system of putting symbols to paper, or stone tablets in their case. This wasn't just a matter of grabbing a Bic pen off the desk and jotting down a quick thought onto a post-it. It was a real task to write something down, etching the symbols into stone. Time-consuming stuff, one would think. Only the most important of notions would be included in this process, especially in these early days. And only the most important were. Farming practices, laws, recipes, things that most people would benefit from knowing and sharing in their common knowledge. Why a ghost story? Why include that? Something to think about. Now, ancient Mesopotamians did not just include the concept of earthbound spirits in their writing, it was artistically rendered as well. The oldest drawing of a ghost ever found, according to British Museum curator Irving Finkel, comes from the 4th century BCE Mesopotamia. On the back of a tablet that has been inscribed in cuneiform, a how-to guide for ridding an especially obstinate ghost of their attachment to a living person, two figures have been etched into the stone. A woman in a dress holding one end of a rope that is tied around the wrists of what appears to be a bearded man. The manual states that this woman has been created as a companion to the ghost in order to redirect his focus and convince him to go into the underworld where he belongs. I have included all reference links for today's show in the notes for anyone curious in checking out that image. Please do. Another very early ghost story comes from Pliny the Younger, who lived from 61 AD to 113 AD. This one is a more commonly known early ghost story and is also one of the oldest tales of a haunted house, originally purported to have taken place in 200 BC. In a letter to Roman Senator Lucius Sura, he details out the story of Athenodorus renting or buying a reputably haunted home in Athens. An apparition haunts it that is so horrifying the original tenants lost all sleep and in their delusional exhaustion died from the fright. But Athenodorus, ever the logical man, ever the stoic, said, "Meh, the price is good," and so bought the home. Determined to not be taken with fear and be deterred from his work, he set about to writing. In the middle of the night, the ghost appeared. An old man, skinny and dirty, with a long beard and rattling the shackles and chains on his feet and hands, beckoned Athenodorus to follow. And Athenodorus said, "Please hold one moment," and continued furiously writing. You know how it is. When you're in the flow, when someone interrupts that, After a moment, the ghost was like, "Homie, let's go," and beckoned him again. Athenodorus would follow the apparition, this time, into the courtyard where it promptly vanished. The spot was marked and later dug up to reveal the skeleton of a man shackled with chains. The bones were properly laid to rest, and the ghost haunted the house no more. The restless ghost with a need to fulfill before they can be at peace is a theme we still incorporate today. The ghost is vengeful for a wrong done to them. They need something they hid found. They need to stay to protect someone. They need to stay because they are afraid. It's a common belief that some kind of need is what creates a ghost. That ghosts are, inherently unhappy, sad, or angry for it, that they rely on the living in order to give them what they need to help them, all the while getting more frustrated over the years as they continue to go ignored or unnoticed altogether. But it is a theme, nevertheless. And why? Because, philosophically speaking, there is a ghost problem. And in a weird way, even if this is not what actually creates a ghost, conceptualizing them in this way is our solution. It's a way to make sense of something people are currently claiming and have claimed to encounter since the beginning. Even how they look has not changed much in all this time, despite what the most ardent skeptics will tell you. They bring up the Onryo of Japan. Ooh, the transparent versus non-transparent ghost. The bedsheet ghost. Look, 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 why do they seem to change based on the period and the latest advancements? Because cultural interpretations about anything is going to change the way we perceive something. That is why. I can't tell you if the Onryo, the classic deathly pale girl with the black hair and a white dress, is a real thing. But do I think it could be based on something real? Sure. I can't tell you why transparent ghosts were more prevalent at certain times and not others. But I can tell you it seems like that distinction is splitting hairs, and it's clear to me that even though I don't understand the mechanics of how a ghostly manifestation works, that it seems to be based in the same phenomenon. I'm not going to go too far off into the weeds about my theory of everything here, but I will throw out there this idea that human beings and their psyches, how we are intaking the information around us, is the common denominator in all of the paranormal experiences that have and will ever occur. But they are describing something similar within each phenomenon, despite the cultural differences. So, what does that mean when someone is actually seeing something similar, but describing it with subtle differences in appearance? Perhaps it is a perception issue, and we are perceiving it in the way that our minds have been prepared to interpret a thing. That was a little far into the weeds. My brain is fritzing. but look, bottom line, yes, the ghost has had different interpretations across the cultures and the centuries, but ultimately always comes back down to it being a fairly accurate representation of a person who was once alive. How can that be if folks haven't actually been encountering the same phenomenon? And another thing, this is something I always look for when it comes to these history deep dives, is how prevalent was the phenomenon throughout history? Ghosts and hauntings have not wavered. It's an inconvenient truth that some paranormal phenomena do just seem to suddenly appear in the historic record, still old, but suddenly make an appearance at a certain place in our evolution. And that can be for, you know, one reason or another, of course. But ghosts? The Sumerians invented writing. They took down the stuff that was important to take down. How to grow crops. How to make beer. What do the gods want from you? How to not go around murdering people all willy-nilly, I presume, I hope. Ghosts. And then, from then to now, this phenomenon is not ducking and weaving. We can look to any period, and it will be there, standing right behind you. Egyptians also believed that ghosts could come back to haunt, cause problems. So ghosts in themselves were viewed as a problem to be rectified. Egyptian beliefs in the afterlife changed a bit over time. Originally, they considered the immortal aspect of a person to be just one thing they called the ku. At some point, though, Egyptians would come to believe that the ku was actually comprised of 9 different parts that all did different things upon death. 2 aspects of the soul called the ba and ka joined forces to become the ak. The ock is what made a ghost, as it contained the two components of personality and spirit, ba and ka. Confused yet? Well, good news, this is where things become familiar again. It was believed so long as a soul was happy in their afterlife, there was no need or desire for these aspects of their soul to return to the land of the living, unless there was a wrong to address or their burial had not been properly done, or done at all. These souls would actually get permission from the gods to return to Earth and make things right. Ancient Greeks and Romans also viewed the reasoning behind the return of a ghost to Earth pretty much the same. The afterlife starts to take a turn for the better at this point. Though if Greeks held a belief in ghosts, Romans said, hold my mead, brother. They had a bit stronger belief in ghosts and superstition in general. As to the afterlife, the Romans had Elysian fields, a literal paradise, the plain of Asphodel for all the regular good folk to go. Even their, concept of hell was not that bad. Tartarus was where the darker souls were sent, but only until they had atoned for what they had done, and then they would be sent to join the others in the plain of Asphodel. But again, it was thought souls had no reason to return unless it was of utmost importance to do so. Now, with the Romans, we start to see an interesting defining of ghosts. They would begin to discern between different types of them and set a predictability when it came to encounters with them. They had a few different beliefs about ghosts and the underworld and afterlife, and it seems like they couldn't always make up their mind and things changed. Hard to follow. But what is clear is the Romans liked the idea of ghosts, and they thought a lot about them. Two common types of apparitions were the Manus and the Lemurus. Simply put, Manus were the benevolent spirits of deceased loved ones, and Lemurus were not so great. These were the restless, haunting ghosts tied to the physical realm via their bad deeds while alive, evil acts, bad deaths, or they just couldn't find a way out. They were envisioned to be black and featureless forms and malevolent. Does that description sound familiar to any of my shadow figure hunters out there? Lemurus were considered the restless, the wandering, the vengeful. They were angry or had been overlooked and could cause a ruckus for the living. The Romans held ceremonies and sacrifices to placate the unhappy Lemurus and also to honor the Manus with both private and public celebrations. They also believed that Lemurus would appear physically at a certain time of night and could only be seen with the aid of some kind of light. The ghosts of deceased loved ones or friends, however, would appear in your dreams and were believed to be very beneficial to the living, providing advice or even warning of things to come. Ghosts were described and depicted in ancient Chinese literature. The Chinese ultimately arrived at a dualistic view of the soul in the late 4th, early 3rd century BC. The two parts of the soul they called Hun and Po. Po represented a person's animal soul and their instincts. It was the earth soul, very attached to the physical realm. This formed in the womb and would carry a human through, allowing its counterpart soul to develop until around the age of 20, when that second soul part, the Hun, would solidify and be fully formed. Hun represented personality and intelligence. It was the spirit soul. Upon death, the Hun and Po would have to cross a bridge to get to the afterlife. At this bridge, they would be judged and their fate would befall them. Either they would venture on into heaven or fall off the bridge into hell. Now, following the person's death, the two parts of their soul could return to Earth to haunt the living and create two very different types of hauntings. The Poe haunting is your traditional haunting. They haunt houses, people. They appear to anyone asking for help. They are what you think of when you think of a ghost in a traditional sense. The Hun haunting was a little different because this part of the soul was not attached to your body as much as the Poe was. The Hun could create situations with spirit possession, reanimation of already dead corpses of other people, and they would be the aspect doing whatever it needed to do in order to take actual revenge on the living. A little bit scarier, I think. The reasons a person's Hun and Poe would return are exactly what you think and what every example we've talked about thus far held as their reasons. These reasons haven't changed. The Poe and Hun joining forces to come back to Earth and haunt the living were known as Gui, the Mandarin term for ghost. Now, there were different designated terms for these ghosts depending on where they haunted and what they did. The Shui Gui were found haunting bodies of water where they drowned. They would try to lure people into the water in order to drown them. The Zheng Shi were seen as predatory zombie ghosts who stole people's breath. Nu Gui were the ghosts of women who had been murdered, who would haunt the location where she was killed and kill any man who crossed her path. Ba Jiao Gui were evil ghosts who had been addicts or had died by committing suicide. There was real fear when it came to ghosts. Not spirits of ancestors who were happy and satisfied in their afterlife, but if you had a ghost on your hands, it was never for a good reason, and the Chinese took measures and great care to ward off and rid themselves of anything to do with them. Knowing what I know now about modern Japanese and Korean cinema, it is not shocking that they literally have the scariest versions of ghosts in the current day. Stuff of nightmares, dudes. But yeah, by all sources that I have researched, ghosts were not great. They were very real to them and highly feared. Ghost stories were the earliest form of literature in ancient China. So leave it to the Chinese to put forth the first ghost hunter in history. Well, not literally, it's folklore, but still kind of cool ghost history. Zheng Kui is a hunter of ghosts who himself is a ghost. Folklore goes that Zheng Kui was incredibly smart and always had top honors when it came to exam taking. One day, he took part in the statewide imperial exams held in the capital. He aced them, of course, but his rightful title of winner, winner, chicken dinner was stripped from him by the emperor because, as smart as Zheng Kui was, unfortunately, he was disfigured and ugly. Zheng Kui committed suicide and was laid to rest by a friend. During his judgment after his death, an underworld judge saw Zheng Kui's potential, his superior intelligence, and gave him the title of King of Ghosts. He was then tasked with hunting, capturing, and taking charge of all ghosts and maintaining order among the restless. Pictures of him were hung in Chinese houses in order to scare away spirits and demons. Vanquisher of evil beings, ghost hunter, Zheng Kui, ladies and gents. Let's shift over to medieval Europe, the Middle Ages, circa 476 to 1500. Ah, paradise on earth, right? What a lovely time to be alive. So easy. So clean. Definitely didn't smell like a poopy urinal cake left to bake in the Saharan sun. How the hell are we here right now? Y'all ever wonder that? Like, you guys know everybody was walking around with some, like, indescribable rankness. Like, how did they stomach reproducing? I mean, I'm grateful. Don't get me wrong. But anyway, what a lovely time to be a wandering spirit, too, apparently. Now, in the early Middle Ages, up to about the year 1000, the church, in their efforts to distance their beliefs and traditions from the pagans, but also steal and rebrand a bunch from the pagans, labeled ghosts demons. Clearly, they were demons, because if God was almighty, all-powerful, how were the spirits of the deceased pulling a fast one on him and avoiding the designated destinations of either heaven or hell? Clearly, these apparitions had to be demons, taking on the form of dead loved ones to tempt and deceive. Clearly! Stupid pagans. This ghosts are demons concept would change down the road as soon as the church could figure out a way to fit God into it, but for the time being, that was how it was. But even so, ghost stories and encounters were being told. From the life of Saint Germanus of Auxerre, written in the 5th century, Bishop Germanus was said to have visited a remote village where the locals reported being terrorized by a mysterious ghostly figure. Germanus performed an exorcism and then laid the spirit to rest, saving the villagers and putting a stop to further haunting activity. In the 6th century, Pope Gregory I wrote of a monk who appeared to his brethren after death to ask for prayers and alms to help his soul find peace. In the late 7th century, a monk named Adomnin recounted the life and miracles of St. Columba. In one instance, Columba encountered a wandering spirit doomed to wander because it had not received a proper burial. The saint provided the spirit the necessary rites, and the haunting presumably ceased. These may be total fiction, just fabrication, bedtime stories at best, but that is not the point. The point is that even in the face of the church pushing the idea that ghosts were demons, religious figures were telling stories of human ghosts needing help, needing to be dealt with, not demons. And in the face of the church downplaying ghosts, attempting to stamp out the superstition, the stories kept a-coming. If the spectral were nothing more than a belief and superstition with no actual leg to stand on, I mean, medieval Christianity would have been the nail in its coffin. It was not the time to be playing. You know what I mean? To drive the prevalence of reports, fiction or otherwise, home, a historian from the 2nd century named William of Newburgh, who documented a number of ghost accounts, would say that if he were to devote himself just to recording ghost stories, his work would never end because they were so common. The theme of a soul in need persisted, and these stories so continued being put out there, published, that even the church couldn't avoid it. So their tune changed after developing the concept of purgatory, a concept stolen from Plato, a third place people could go. Not heaven, not hell, not good, not necessarily bad, but if you had not been the pinnacle of God-fearing perfection, if you had sins unatoned for that weren't hell-worthy, and you still had heaven potential, to purgatory you go. A place neither here nor there, where you wait to be redeemed enough by the prayers of the living to help elevate you to the pearly gates. The church's view would change in the 11th and 12th centuries, because now God had a hand in this. God deemed it so that souls exist in purgatory and the living are to participate in helping them make amends. And the living cannot do that unless they can see and then know the deceased are actually in purgatory. So that is where ghosts come from, and purgatory is located on earth. Did I get that right? Sure feels like it sometimes.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly, but then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up for $4.99 each with your card and a digital coupon. Then buy one, get one free on our full line sale of tender Tyson chicken with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
So, for the first part of the Middle Ages, ghosts were demons and a no-no, but they had a ghost problem, which led to the second half of the Middle Ages, where with the introduction of purgatory, now ghosts were human spirits stuck and needing our help. However, with the birth of the Reformation, ghosts again became demonic under Protestant theology, thanks to their rejection of the idea of purgatory. But accounts of appearances of the dead continued to spread across England throughout the 17th century, and everyone else had grown far more accepting of the idea that the spirits of our deceased loved ones were still within our reach. So the Protestants weren't the only voice in the room. Many voices dissented, pressing on with the ghosts are real and just right there argument, even using it to combat the sudden rise in a little belief system known as atheism. The first anthologies of ghost stories would appear in the mid-1600s, followed by more. People had an appetite for these accounts. Which brings us to the Victorian era, 1800s. There was a lot taking place in this time period, all contributing to one of the most dramatic and flamboyant times for ghost representation that would ultimately shape a lot of our current day beliefs about them. This was a time of great social upheaval, inequity, of trying to balance reason with revelation, logical faith in science with a longing for the romantic, for the innocent, for the wonder. If the 17th century gave birth to the rise of the skeptical atheist, by the 1800s, it was full-blown and gave smug middle-class morality and intellectualists a comfortable place to sit. But if that is so, then how did the Victorians give us some of the most memorable ghost stories? How did this period give rise, ultimately, to the spiritualism movement? There was indeed a reliance in rationalism and a new faith being placed in science and technological advances. There was an explosion of logic, advancements in medicine, electromagnetism, physical sciences, and in turn, a general scoffing attitude of those old-world, primitive, faith-based mentalities. Well, almost in direct response to this movement was a counter-movement of romanticism, a craving for innocence, simpler times, emotional depth. And because at the time, death rates were so high, especially among the lower classes, death ages were so early due to completely treatable conditions by today's standards, Victorians thought about death and grew to be fascinated with the supernatural and the spiritual. A lot of their attitudes towards death and the spiritual were, to a degree, a direct product of this romanticism movement. They kind of grew obsessed with things more macabre. For instance, being buried alive. This was a real fear, and not entirely without basis in reality. People were buried alive, but there were tons of articles, published on the matter. how common it was, what to do if you were buried alive. The London Association for the Prevention of Premature Burial was a real thing. The creation of elaborate signaling devices in coffins and tombs were a real thing. Another side of the Victorians' obsession with death and the darker side of things was articulated in their Gothic horror and ghost stories. The Victorian ghost story was an interesting vehicle to get a lot of points across. It was used to communicate societal issues, inequities between the classes, fears of change, injustices. They were used to teach morals. They were used to articulate fear of death and the unknown. And boy, could they be entertaining. The Haunted Mill, most of Edgar Allan Poe, Dickens' Christmas Carol. The Victorians even created the tradition of telling ghost stories during Christmas time. But these were, without a doubt, fiction created for entertainment's sake, often forgotten, are the other type of ghost story being told at the time, the far more mundane, even boring story, the true accounts, because people were still actually seeing ghosts, claiming to. And these types of accounts would be submitted and oftentimes ignored by the Society for Psychical Research in their investigation into the matter of hauntings in the later 1800s, unless they included visual anomalies in them. The SPR was founded in the latter 1800s and quickly launched investigations into things psychical and also ghosts and hauntings because it was important enough to do so, because these reports were just that common. Now, during the Victorian era, a parallel to the general evolution of thoughts about death and the unknown was a-brewing. Mesmerism had captured people's attention and was theorized to be a vehicle for connection to the other side. It was a popular belief in the 1800s that mesmerism held secrets of the other world and provided a link to it. Mesmerism quietly gave way to the trance medium, so when a couple of sisters in the mid-1800s told the world they had started hearing knocking on their Rochester, New York home walls, belief about the supernatural and fascination with death and the other side came to a head, and the explosion of spiritualism was inevitable, and upon them. Spiritualism would bring some of the greatest criticism of the existence of ghosts, hauntings, the afterlife, and things unknown that human history has ever observed. We saw the introduction of ghost photography by William Mumler debunked. We saw the rise and miserable fall of physical mediumship due to highly debatable and easily debunked practitioners performing tricks like table tipping, glowing ghostly appendage manifestations, levitations, luminescent ectoplasm produced from God knows where, all to the detriment of the phenomenon that seemed to actually be taking place. And because people wanted explanations for it, they wanted answers, and opportunistic greed answered the call. It's easy to look back now and see just how ridiculous some of the events and the people that spiritualism created were, but people's curiosity about the other side and the mystery of ghostly appearances wasn't born in a vacuum. It wasn't born in the 1800s. The phenomenon was already ancient by that point and was being driven by personal experiences and accounts that to this day have not satisfactorily been explained. Like the haunting of Willington Mill House, in the early 1800s, the Proctor family was terrorized by an unseen nuisance in their home. It all started with footsteps and no explanation, followed by bolder poltergeist activity and then apparition manifestations in the following years. The Willington Mill House would actually be the site of one of the first recorded ghost hunts in England, and it was documented by the skeptical Mr. Proctor in his diary and only published after his and his wife's death. He was a skeptic and was literally upset or frustrated with his wife for her imaginings of these ghostly footsteps that she was hearing in the beginning. He would be forced to change his tune when the weird activity kept taking place and would include the events in his journal to document the things that were undeniably occurring in his home. The most notorious ghost story from the time, the Bell Witch, old Britt Bailey's ghost, and a ghost light being seen since the 1830s outside of Angleton, Texas, documented at that time, still seen today. But if spiritualism can be credited for something good, credit it for bringing the topics of mediumship, anomalous activity, and the occurrence of ghosts and hauntings into the modern era and under the microscope of current-day investigators, researchers, and scientific study of it. As weird as it sounds, I don't think we would have arrived at the current level of acceptance of it without the ridiculous flamboyance but illuminating publicity of the spiritualism movement. So, how did we shape and advance the study of ghosts in the 20th century? What were ghosts up to during that time? Pretty much more of the same, which is good for those curious enough to study it, because it gives us a foundation to work from and apply newer advances in technology and understanding of science that people of the past did not have access to. The 1900s also put the investigation of things spectral directly in the hands of the larger public, for better or worse. Let's run through a quick timeline of key events and hauntings in the aftermath of spiritualism that land us where we currently are on the matter. Harry Price was one of the most influential figures to come out in the early days following the spiritualism movement in the field of paranormal investigation and ghost research, and can arguably be called one of the first actual ghost hunters. Not a ghost who was a ghost hunter, sorry, Jean-Cui, like what we would ultimately come to see on television and what now countless groups do in haunted locations across the world. His work would shape many investigation methods still incorporated today. In 1929, he would take on the Borley Rectory case in England, which he would become well known for, and during which would lay a blueprint for paranormal investigations to follow, printing the first ever handbook on how to conduct an investigation. He would also introduce the idea of the ghost hunter's kit, equipped with tape measure, still cameras for indoor and outdoor photos, a remote control motion picture camera, and portable telephones for investigators so they could contact each other. No walkies back then. Thanks to Price's investigation and numerous other witnesses over the years, the Borley Rectory was known as England's most haunted house. In 1965, the Rhine Research Center, previously founded in 1935 as the Duke Parapsychology Laboratory, was officially founded by J.B. Rhine, which is important for the laying of groundwork for modern-day parapsychology. A photo was captured in 1936 of a ghostly woman in brown descending the stairs in Raynham Hall and was published in Country Life magazine. This photo and its negative were inspected for fakery, and it was found to be innocent of it by Harry Price, and following an exhaustive investigation of it by the Society for Psychical Research, they concluded it was almost certainly a mundane explanation for the spectral image, possibly leaked light on the photographic plate, but nothing more than a maybe by them was ascertained at the time. It is still considered by many to be a genuine capture of a phantom. In 1952, Ed and Lorraine Warren founded the New England Society for Psychic Research, which is the oldest ghost hunting group in New England. Their work and books following this of course, would massively shape the direction of ghost investigation and theories as to what is taking place with their publicity of cases like Amityville, Annabelle, and the Enfield poltergeist case. Though the Ouija board had been patented as a parlor game in 1891, spiritualist Pearl Curran would popularize it as a divining tool during World War I. Parker Brothers would acquire it in 1966 to be sold widely, commercially, and of course it would get really well known with the release of The Exorcist in the 70s. The Stanford Research Institute would begin early work in the study of remote viewing in the 50s, which would ultimately lend a sense of credibility to some down the road to the serious study of the weird. The Parapsychological Association was created in 1957, which would become affiliated with the American Association for the Advancement of Science in 1969, the largest scientific society in the world. In 72, the Philip experiment was conducted by a team in Toronto, Canada, to determine if the human will and mind were playing a part in communication with ghosts. This group created a fictional character named Philip and conducted a series of seances until participants, full well knowing Philip was not real, began to report being able to feel his presence, table vibrations, unexplained breezes, unexplained echoes, rapping sounds that supplied answers to questions that were being asked, and the table lifting until it was balanced on only one leg. These experiments were successful and are important because they sparked debate about the nature of hauntings and whether some ghost phenomena could actually be manifestations of human thought. Important for poltergeist cases, definitely, but also, I think, for regular hauntings as well, and ties into my own theory of everything. It's such a strange event, but undeniable, with the audio and video captures of the phenomena and also the participants' witness accounts. In 1977, The Amityville Horror was published, documenting claims by the Lutz family of all their paranormal experiences in their haunted house and the murders that preceded a year prior and presumably were also affected by, as well as fed into, the Lutz's experiences. One Step Beyond, the first television series to air in the U.S. based on real-life encounters with the paranormal, aired from 59 to 61, followed by In Search Of, 15 years later, and Unsolved Mysteries in 1987. Ghost, starring Patrick Swayze and Demi Moore, was released in 1990. I don't think that was necessarily a detriment or a help to the investigation of ghosts, but it had an effect on popular culture's collective ideas and opinions on the matter. The capture of EVP saw a surge in popularity, and the Gauss meter was introduced to investigators in the 90s, both widely used by them today. The Ghost Box was created in 2002 by Frank Sumption for the purpose of real-time communication with the dead. Ghost Hunters premiered in 2004, Paranormal State in 2007, and Ghost Adventures in 2008, all of which would shape and solidify the future of ghost hunting. 2014 introduced the SLS camera, when it was used for the first time on Ghost Adventures episode St. James Hotel. The SLS was invented by engineer Bill Chappell and is based off of gaming technology. From the year 2000 to present, purportedly haunted locations across the nation have been extensively investigated and the evidence shared with the public, including Eastern State Penn, the Queen Mary, Waverly Hills, the Myrtles Plantation, the Sally House, Winchester House, the Bellwitch Cave, Bobby Mackey's, and hundreds more. Paranormal investigation teams now span the country. Parapsychology research centers are going strong in their studies and experiments. Several studies have been conducted exploring the relationship between electromagnetic fields and infrasound and their effects on paranormal experiences. several studies conducted on neurological and psychological studies and their relation to experiences, new investigation equipment is being released consistently, ghost apps have exploded into existence in just the past few years, information and evidence is pumped through numerous peer-reviewed journals and publications. The search for an answer to our ghost problem is ongoing. It's a constant stream of searching and evidence collecting, and thankfully, we all now have equal access to it. It is a special time in this long human history and long history of ghosts where, for once, it is acceptable enough to explore the subject. We have full right to the information. We can go out there and get it for ourselves if we desire. We can learn for ourselves what it's all about and have equipment and methods to do so at our disposal. It's hard to know where to end the history when the phenomenon and search for answers is ever ongoing. So, I will just say this. What I have learned from today's information is throughout history, the phenomenon of ghosts has remained remarkably consistent. That despite the time that has passed, despite rational skepticism or church dogma or periods of fraud or instances of fakery, it has persisted. And based on this ramping up energy we see in just this last century and a more recent enthusiasm for personal discovery, we now stand on a precipice. More people than ever are ready for an answer, an explanation. At this moment in time, when our curiosity can intersect with the technology of today, learn from the mistakes of the past, and incorporate advancements of our predecessors, I think it's a very real possibility we could become part of that history in the making. Generations from before could only guess, could only wonder. We could know. That's all I've got for you today. Please join me for a final note. Here's an interesting thing I found in my history exploration, and is in itself an example of how our perceptions and concepts of the ghostly can completely change without it having anything whatsoever to do with the reality of the phenomenon. If I asked you to put pen to paper right now and draw me a ghost, what's that image look like? If you are not being difficult with this imagined task, you would draw a white floaty sheet with some eye holes, maybe a little smiley face if you're feeling spicy. Why? Why did you draw that? You and I and everyone else knows that is not what a ghost looks like, right? Well, much like the artificial flavors of purple grape or banana in candy don't really taste anything like the real fruit, but whenever we taste the candy, we'll automatically say, yeah, that flavor is definitely purple grape or banana. I cannot be the only one who thinks that is so weird. But much like that, it's an association that we have made that's been a long time in the making. The bedsheet ghost has its roots in historical burial practices and is believed to originate from the way deceased bodies were treated before things like embalming came along. In centuries past, especially in Europe, it was common to wrap corpses in shrouds, white sheets, before burial. Coffins either were not used, were not an option due to financial class, or were just not readily available. So shrouds served as a way to cover the body respectfully and to protect it during burial. As a result, the shrouded figure became associated with death, mourning, and the afterlife. In the 18th and 19th centuries, ghost stories became a form of entertainment because of the Victorians' obsession with death and dying, and because they liked to be extra gothic and macabre, the image of the shrouded figure began to appear in literature, theater, and artwork. And from there, the association with ghosts covered in shrouds became the easy visual. A white, floating, besheeted figure was an easy way to signal to audiences that they were seeing a ghost. The motif became further entrenched in popular culture throughout the Victorian era and carried over into the 20th century, where the motif was then used to portray ghosts in cartoons, comics, and films, immediately recognizable and often comical. It was so simple and easily understood that it was made a staple in children's media and Halloween imagery. So there you have it, the bedsheet ghost. Is just our shorthand for a ghost. Follow the show at Paranormal Girl Pod on social and YouTube. Rate 5 stars if you're loving the program. I sure appreciate it. If you really want to show me some love, share this or any episode link with a friend. Most new listeners to a podcast only come after it's been recommended to them by someone who already enjoys it. Share the education. Share the love. Tune in next week for a conversation with paranormal investigator, host of the Unseen Paranormal Podcast, and owner of the haunted 200-year-old Night House, Eric Freeman Sims. I and the cast of Beer, Booze, and Boogeymen will be at the Night House on September 28th. We'll be kicking the evening off with a live-streamed episode. We hope everyone can join us for that. I do believe we are telling ghost stories, which will totally set the mood for what's to follow. Following the stream, our overnight investigation will commence and stream to our Indiegogo contributors and virtual investigators for the evening. So incredibly excited for this event. It's been a long time in the making, a lot of campaigning and planning and sweat and tears. I can't believe it is just around the corner. If you have your ticket for the event, definitely catch next week's chat with Eric. You'll learn a heck of a lot about the location before we go in. And ghost birds. Yes, you heard me right. Don't miss it. I'll see you guys then. Have a great rest of your week and stay safe. Keep the nightlight on and sleep with one eye open.